again to another chapter and podcast of Cosmic Careers with your host, Veronica Chiaravalli, and myself, Alistair Brown.
Welcome.
This week, we have entered part 3 of Cosmic Careers, the technical infrastructure, and we will be talking about the technical side of space development. But don't worry, it will be in a language you will all understand, and for careers, you with non-technical skills will still need to listen to all this. So don't any of you go anywhere.
The subject for today is space transportation, or what the chapter of this book is called, Transportation from Here to There and When We're There. Tell us now briefly about the beginning.
Spaceflight began in 1944 when an unmanned German V-2 rocket crossed the 62-mile, 100-kilometer line which borders space. The goal here was to bomb London because there was a war on.
World War II. But the Americans managed to get the best rocket scientists when the war ended. The Soviets also managed to get a few. But the Americans looted the base of its best rockets first.
However, this didn't stop the Soviets from launching the world's first satellite in 1957, Sputnik, which reached Earth orbit, and the rest is history.
But everything there was controlled by the governments of both the Soviet Union and the United States.
Up until 2004, when Spaceship One became the first privately funded spacecraft to reach space, twice within 2 weeks.
That was a part of XPRIZE. In fact, they won that one.
They sure did. It was piloted by Mike Melville, and 5 days later by Brian Binney.
Moving on, as we settle space, we do need an infrastructure consisting of space transportation, because that is vital.
A rocket or spaceship would take off from Earth, docking with a way station. Passengers and cargoes would then transfer to other ships destined for the moon and other points in space, such as space factories, mines, and other habitats. The moon would have an orbiting way station, not the presently proposed Lunar Gateway, but a single-purpose way station to transfer passengers and cargo to a lunar ferry to travel to and from the lunar surface. Now, an alternative would be to journey directly from the Earth in its way station directly to the lunar surface. This will depend on the structure of the ship itself and if it's capable of functioning like this.
You've mentioned that spaceships were originally built by NASA and other governments all the way up to the space shuttle, but President Obama did something really radical about this.
In 2010, President Barack Obama made the decision to put all future space transportation destined for low Earth orbit, and this includes the International Space Station, into private hands. This was one of the best moves ever made for the U.S. space program. Not only did it set off a revolution in private space vehicles, known as space taxis, but companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin and others helped to lower the cost of space transportation, up to 90% in some cases. Now, a space shuttle launch has costed $1.5 billion, but a launch from SpaceX could cost $67 million. That's 15% of the cost of the shuttle. One reason is that different companies manufacture different parts of the shuttle, resulting in high costs, while one company, like SpaceX, would manufacture the entire rocket, cutting costs by 85%. Granted, other government rockets are cheaper than the shuttle. The Atlas V rocket costs $109 million a launch, but still not as cheap as SpaceX or Blue Origin. This lowers the risk factor for companies that want to launch their satellites or experiments into space, simply by launch costs alone.
Private rockets in their infancy still explode upon launch and do need constant improvement. Starship was launched twice and still has yet to make a successful launch.
Like any new piece of technology, there will be bugs in the system that have to be ironed out. Propulsion systems need improvement. As of the present, we are mostly on chemical propulsion, and there are various kinds of fuel in this technology to power a rocket. The Atlas Centaur rocket, which began in 1962, the Saturn V rocket, which took Apollo to the moon, and SpaceX's Falcon 9 all used kerosene, with liquid oxygen as the oxidizer. SpaceX later used methane and liquid oxygen. Blue Origin used several combinations, such as kerosene and peroxide, along with methane and liquid oxygen. But the real workhorse of fuels, both now and in the future, is and will be liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. As liquid hydrogen and oxygen combine, they release enormous amount of energy with water as a byproduct. This would be a major use of ice from the moon and asteroids. It would be melted in the water, and by electrolysis with energy from the sun, water would pass through electricity, separating the hydrogen and oxygen, and be recombined to fuel spaceships or just provide needed energy. Both hydrogen and oxygen need to be stored at extremely low temperatures. Hydrogen at minus 253 degrees Celsius and oxygen at minus 180 degrees Celsius in orbital refueling stations. This would be for space vehicles from Earth to be refueled before continuing on to their destinations.
Nuclear propulsion, unpopular as it is here on Earth, will be the way to go in space.
Nuclear propulsion has been experimented with since 1955, starting with NERVA, the nuclear engine for rocket vehicle application. Don't forget, nuclear power is used to power ships and submarines. This was a nuclear thermal rocket, an NTR, and was a great success and ran until 1973. It briefly came back to life in 1983 for the Strategic Defense Initiative, but was turned down, but returned in the early 1990s when Marshall Space Flight Center saw the value of it in interplanetary travel. In May 2019, Congress approved $125 million for nuclear thermal propulsion development.
How much better are nuclear rockets as opposed to chemical-based rockets?
A nuclear thermal rocket uses a nuclear reactor to heat propellant to a high temperature, which is then expanded by a supersonic nozzle to produce thrust, like a conventional rocket engine. Nuclear rockets are more fuel efficient than chemical rockets, and they're lighter, not having to carry so much weight of the fuel, and can travel twice as fast. For example, at the closest point between Earth and Mars, chemical rockets take 8 to 9 months to reach Mars, while a nuclear rocket will take only 4 months. This also reduces exposure to cosmic rays and solar winds in interplanetary travel, simply by speed alone.
Nuclear rockets would not be popular launched from Earth. In fact, the population worldwide would form massive protests about it.
What concerns people is the use of radioactive components. So, to be on the safe side, chemical rockets would be used to travel from the surface of the Earth, carrying both passengers and cargo to way stations in low Earth orbit. The passengers and cargo would then be transferred to nuclear-propelled spacefaring ships that would never land on Earth as they journey out to the moon and other destinations. So here we have two options. First, build all nuclear-powered spaceships or their engines on the moon, or build them on Earth and launch them on chemical rockets to space and transfer the engine to a nuclear space vehicle for attachment.
Next on the agenda are the space vehicles themselves. We will discuss reusable launch vehicles, single stage to orbit vehicles, two stage to orbit vehicles, and hypersonics.
The Space Shuttle was the first attempt at a reusable launch vehicle. It launched using the ship attached to an external tank, and there were two boosters on the side. The boosters and the shuttle were reused, but the external tank was discarded, and it took up to 2 months or more to refurbish the shuttle before it was used again. Although the shuttle was launched vertically and landed horizontally, what we really want is a single space vehicle that would both take off and land horizontally, like a conventional airplane.
What about the legendary X-15?
Ah, that's a good one. Beginning in 1963, we had the X-15, a supersonic jet. This was the first fully reusable space vehicle. It was a needle-nose jet and jointly operated by both the U.S. Air Force and NASA. It had flown all the way up the suborbital space many times. One could feel the weightlessness of space and see the curvature of the Earth. Unfortunately, after each flight, the plane had to be refurbished, and with constant repairs and replacement of parts, the X-15 was too expensive to maintain. NASA canceled the X-15 in favor of expendable rockets. The plane was no doubt ahead of its time, but the needed technology to keep it constant wasn't yet available back in the 1960s.
Tell us about Voyager.
In 1986, and I remember this, Dick Rutan and Jenna Yeager piloted Voyager, a small aircraft that piloted nonstop around the world. The X Prize followed in 2004 when Bert Rutan, Dick's brother, designed Spaceship One, where it was flown to suborbital space and repeated 5 days later. The lid to the RLV, reusable space vehicle concept of cheap access to space, was blown. The question is, going to space is still a complex matter, so what kind of a ship should we have? A single stage to orbit vehicle or a two stage to orbit vehicle? The ideal space plane that travels from Earth to low Earth orbit would take off from any airport and land at another one, horizontally, both ways. With today's technologies, the space plane would require the fuel to be 85% of the vehicle's mass. Now, if the payload is 5% of the launch mass, the remaining 10% would be the vehicle itself. This is a problem.
The solution is to reduce the weight of the space plane itself, especially on the outer surface.
Carbon fiber and lightweight aluminum lithium alloys would be one solution, allowing for a strong vehicle with a greatly reduced weight. And I'm talking about the skin of the airplane.
I understand that a British company are working on just that.
Yes, Reaction Engines Limited designed a single stage to orbit vehicle called Skylon with a ceramic composite skin for protection for re-entering the atmosphere. Initially, it will be unpiloted with the capability of lifting 33,000 pounds or 15,000 kilograms to low Earth orbit. Skylon started out being privately funded, but is now subsidized in part by both the British government and the European Space Agency. Skylon is propelled by a synthetic air-breathing engine, or SABRE. The fuel is liquid hydrogen and uses first the oxygen from the Earth's atmosphere and then switches to liquid oxygen, which it also carries, as the air grows thinner. The liquid oxygen also acts as a coolant to keep the engine from melting. It takes off from a runway and accelerates to Mach 5.4, meaning 5.4 times the speed of sound, to an altitude of 26 kilometers. At this altitude, the air-breathing engine shuts down and the rocket engine, using the liquid oxygen, kicks in and the plane accelerates to Mach 25 to reach an orbit all the way up to 400 clicks or kilometers. After the task is performed, the plane re-enters the atmosphere, protected by the ceramic heat shield, and lands at a spaceport with a 2-day turnaround time.
This sounds like hypersonics. In fact, single stage to orbit and hypersonics seem to go together.
It does. In fact, they seem to be one in the same because I cannot imagine a single stage to orbit plane without hypersonics. I will go back to that shortly, but first I will cover the two-stage to orbit vehicle, for that seems to be the stepping stone to hypersonic vehicles of the SSTO, short for single stage to orbit. The TSTO, two-stage to orbit ship, will consist of two stages, both piloted, and there would be several types. One rocket would be on top of another, launched vertically. This would be good for cargo, but not passengers. Another concept would be both rockets attached to each other on the side, also launched vertically. The last would be one plane riding piggyback on top of a bigger plane, taking off horizontally like an airplane, and after reaching a certain height, say 100 clicks, the space plane would break off and fly to Earth orbit while the bigger plane would return to Earth. This would be best for flying passengers.
Now we return to hypersonics.
Hypersonics have existed since the 1960s in the form of missile technology, but it was in the 1980s where the idea of applying it to passenger airplanes was proposed.
Well, the British and the French already had the Concorde.
That's supersonic. But like the Concorde, the Skylon, and many other planes, a hypersonic plane is to take off from any airport, fly at Mach 25, reach LEO, land at any other airport and take off again immediately. Now, three engines would propel the plane. First, the turbojet, which would launch the plane from the airport up to Mach 2.5. The ramjet would then take over, compressing the air, burn the liquid hydrogen, and then exhaust it, accelerating the plane all the way up to Mach 5.5. The scramjet, the supersonic combustible ramjet engine, would ingest air, mix it with liquid hydrogen, and ignite the hydrogen with the oxygen taken from the atmosphere and thrust the engine to Mach 25 all the way to LEO, or low Earth orbit. Now, in the US, aided by government funding, they worked on the X-30, a two-man hypersonic vehicle for the military, which would lead to the development of the National Aerospace Plane, or NASP, NASP. I remember in September 1988, I attended a symposium at the University of North Dakota, where I was a student, majoring in space studies, by the way, on hypersonics, and guests from many other countries attended. Unfortunately, the hypersonic program was canceled in 1993 due to a lack of perceived necessity and cuts in the federal budget.
As we progress in space, many private companies like SpaceX, Blue Origin, and Virgin Galactic, along with other companies in other countries, will come up with more advanced space vehicles, and hypersonics will make a comeback.
It's inevitable. The demand for transport to LEO will increase exponentially, and space cargo ships and taxis will be built to provide them. They will at first be subsidized by their respective governments until they get the hang of these technologies. This includes orbiting refueling stations and way stations. For the moment at least, both chemical propulsion and nuclear propulsion will coexist.
Now, let's hear what you have for next week.
Next week in Chapter 6, we will cover working in space. This is where the title of this book, Cosmic Careers, really begins to be taken literally. So don't anybody go anywhere. Now you know why you should buy this book. So go to the net or your local bookstore and get your copy of Cosmic Careers today.
Goodbye.
Goodbye until next week.